Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Steinway artist Judy Carmichael, one of the leading interpreters of classic swing and stride piano, and host of NPR's Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired. And we're talking about her new memoir, A Swinger, A Jazz Girl's Adventures from Hollywood to Harlem. Judy, welcome to the show. It's a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to this.
I don't know if I knew what to expect when I started this book, but this is a pretty wild ride.
Many jazz autobiographies that have been written that haven't had a ghost writer, you know, that actually wrote it.
Oh, I know.
So, I mean, that makes it different right there, I would think. At least I haven't seen a lot of them.
And there's not a lot written by women instrumentalists.
No, definitely not.
As a matter of fact, has there been any?
No.
Okay.
We'll clear that up. I don't think so. And I'll tell you something interesting for me. I'm so used to being the only woman in so many situations throughout my life that I don't even think about it anymore. And when I started writing this book, it all came back to me, because as I was writing down different stories and things that I'd experienced, it was really apparent that I was always the only woman. And it wasn't, I'm not saying that as bad or good. It was just a fact that I got used to.
And so, throughout the book, people, you'll be in the odd place on the planet, and people will just stop you and go, "Aren't you Judy Carmichael?"
Yes, that happens a lot.
And is that part of it? Is that because you are the only woman there doing stride piano?
I think so. That's very sensitive of you. I think that that is part of it, and it was not something that I certainly thought about early on, that this is a great advantage, because there were so many disadvantages. I mean, I fell in love with this music and thought, I'm going to see if I can have a career. But it's hard enough to have a jazz career, let alone have a career as a stride pianist and as somebody who's not in that community at all, and on, but it then wound up that everybody remembered me because I stood out so much. Not only was I playing this unusual music for the time, but I was a young blonde girl from California. I really stood out. So I do think that people would say, I mean, then people tell me, they'd say that they were talking to someone, they'd say, "Oh, I heard this great stride pianist." And they'd say, "Was it a woman?" And they'd say, "Yes, well, it was Judy Carmichael." You know, they'd sort of zero in on it very quickly.
Yeah, there's a great quote from you, by the way, talking about making a career as a jazz musician at the very beginning of the book. As a jazz musician, if your phone rings, you're more likely to spend money than to make it. And there's several good pieces of advice to people who are looking for a career in jazz throughout this book. As a matter of fact, I'd strongly recommend, if you're thinking about a career in jazz, read this book. Now, you grew up in Pico Rivera, California. Your parents, by the way, feature incredibly importantly in this book. And I don't want to give away everything in this book, so people need to read it.
Thank you.
But the book takes several very serious turns. And the people listening to you, I mean, you're so effervescent. You know, people are going to go, "Oh, it's just going to be this happy-go-lucky romp," and it's not. It is for the most part, and you sort of pick it up at bad times. But you had some really rough moments, including with your parents.
I did, and I wasn't going to put any of that in the book. It's interesting. I really owe that to a wonderful comedian named Frank King. And we were doing a tour together for a couple of weeks in Europe. And as one does, if you hit it off with somebody that you're touring with, you wind up telling each other your stories. And he'd had a very complicated childhood. And so he knew I was working on this book, and I was doing it while we were on the road. And I'd tell him some story, and he goes, "That's in the book, right?" And I go, "Oh, that can't be in the book." And he kept saying it. And I realized that to have a more complete picture, that I had to include these things. And also, I think everybody has interesting things happen to them. And it's how they deal with it and how they go forward. And that's what I wanted to do. And also, and this is my own something that's bothered me for years in my career and just knowing show business is there's a lot of people who are very disingenuous about how they've gotten where they've gotten. And if they have had something challenging, that's the first thing in their press. Huh. Well, I got over my father falling off a cliff, and that inspired me. Or, you know, and it's just always there, and they use it and abuse it. And it's very offensive to me. And these are things that I have not talked about. I'm there to entertain people. I'm there to make beautiful music, hopefully. But now this was a book that covered how I got to where I am right now and how I use these different things. And I tried to present it in a way that didn't make me special, because everybody has these challenges, but show the way that one artist lives a creative life and show it in a more realistic way, because I think most people are not realistic in their view of how one makes their living as an artist. They think it's either Lady Gaga on one level, or it's the drunk in a bar, but somehow that's romantic on the other level. Well, I just said, A Star Is Born. I just told the whole story, the movie, and I didn't mean it that way. But you know what I mean?
I know what you mean.
Really,
I know.
Stupid about it.
I think this is a very realistic accounting of an artist becoming an artist.
Well, thank you.
It's got all sorts of weird digressions and sort of falling into things backwards and then eventually making it. And let's start there. How did you learn to read music, but you knew nothing of theory? Your first instrument was the ukulele. But thank God you didn't stay with that.
Oh, I'm quite proud of that ukulele, period.
How did you learn the maple leaf rag?
I know, it is pretty amazing. I think it's a kind of common tune for people who can read music, and I could read music. I did learn, took a couple years of piano lessons, and people that are learning the regular John Thompson, which piano students will know,
yep,
the classical music that you start out with, that sort of a way to get into something that's maybe a little, quote, more fun is ragtime, because you know, you've got the classical technique, and you can read well, and you can do it. But at the time, it was beyond my skills, or at least my teacher thought so. But my grandfather had suggested that I learn it, and my mom played piano, and she played a little bit of it, so I heard how it sounded, and I liked the feel of it. I liked the sound of it. So I asked my teacher if she would help me learn it. So I did. I just painstakingly made my way through the piece, and eventually learned it and had a feel for that kind of music. And I think that came from the fact that I was obsessed with old movies. So I watched
those
Fred Astaire movies.
That's right.
And all the 30s and 40s musicals. So I had it in my bones, a real feel for swing music and that kind of syncopated feel.
For people who don't know, and I never just take anything for granted in the audience, what stride piano is like, it's an incredibly demanding style of piano playing.
Yes, it is. And most people don't know that term, even if they know the music. But it was a common term in the early years of jazz, because everybody played some sort of stride piano. That was the style. And it's stride, STRIDE. And it's speaking of the left hand is striding, like taking as if you were walking and taking big strides from the lower bass notes up to the mid-range chords, very much like ragtime does. So on the first beat, so 1, 2, 3, 4, it's going back and forth and bouncing up back and forth between the bass notes up to the chords in the mid-range. And then the ragtime feel was a very straight feel, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then as that sort of grew into jazz and other elements came in, the music got this swing feel, which headed with the beat leaning more on 2 and 4, which gives it that swing, the emphasis on the second and fourth beat. And that's what was then stride, Count Basie, Fats
mm-hmm.
Waller,
mm-hmm.
Duke Ellington, all those guys started out playing that way. So if people have heard swing music or seen a Fred Astaire movie or any of that, they've heard that kind of music. They just don't know that the piano was called stride.
This book is so filled with interesting little interactions throughout your life. And one of your earlier ones that was just wonderful was meeting UB Blake at the Maple Leaf Club.
Isn't that incredible?
It was, I mean, you sort of write about these as just like matter of fact things that happened in your life, but That's like, there were so many meetings like that that you had. That
no, I have thought often that I'm a bit like, you know, either Zelig or Forrest Gump.
Seriously, that's no. Like, exactly.
Oh, yeah, there's things I didn't even put in there that have happened to me that I think because I was aware and I'll never know exactly, but I know I even early in life was, I talk about it in the book, that I was in some beauty contests because I thought that I'd be an actress, and one of the functions was at a skating rink in California that was owned by Charles Schulz. And the big thing is that all the girls that were in the beauty contest got to meet Charles Schulz. So we all met him. But then I left the group because I wanted to go off by myself and just sort of think about all this. And he, next thing I know, there's Charles Schulz. And he sits down. And he says, "May I join you?"
Wow.
And he joins me. And I have this whole conversation that we've both skipped out on the main event. And so things, I've been very, very fortunate in that those kind of things have happened to me. And I think I've always been very appreciative of it. So it's developed. I guess, I can't tell you exactly why, but I have definitely been a Zelig kind of character, Forrest Gump.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Steinway artist Judy Carmichael.
Ta-ta-ta.
That's actually written out in her... T-A-T-A-T-A. One of the leading interpreters of classic swing and stride piano, host of Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired, and we're talking about her new memoir. It's a crazy book. It's wild. Swinger.
I'm so glad you think so. I'm really pleased. That's exactly the reaction I would like.
I'm so glad because I literally just sat there and read the whole thing. I didn't put it down. It's Swinger! Exclamation point. A jazz girl's adventures from Hollywood to Harlem. Hey, you know, Judy, you need to explain how you got the name Judy Carmichael.
Oh, I know. Isn't that interesting, too?
That's like another wild story.
I know. No, it is a really... I'm telling you, these things, it is wild. And it was fun revisiting it, writing this book, because even I was going, yeah, I remember that. I did... I was acting then, or auditioning for things, and I was doing, you know, nothing heavy, some civic light opera and school plays and things like that. And my family name is actually von Hohenstein, which no one can pronounce, remember, anything. It's a German name, obviously. And but I grew up with everybody saying Hohenstein, and so when I got an agent, the first thing they said is, "You've got to get rid of that name. Nobody's ever going to remember it." So I was in the middle of thinking, what name am I going to use, when I got a concert, the first concert I've ever given.
Right.
And I was 17, and it was at Royce Hall at UCLA in California. And it was Paul Weston and Joe Stafford were in it, who I didn't even know who they were, but of course my parents did and went nuts. And Edgar Bergen, who some people will know.
I know Edgar Bergen, yeah.
Right, right, and a ventriloquist and father of Candace Bergen. And so it was all of them and Judy Hohenstein. And so I played my one tune, my Maple Leaf Rag, and afterwards I went backstage, and Paul Weston took me aside and said, "I haven't heard that played so well since Hoagie Carmichael's mother got up out of the audience at a club I was playing in the 30s and played Maple Leaf Rag." And I didn't know who Hoagie Carmichael was. I didn't know any of this. But I thought, Carmichael, that's a really good name. Judy Carmichael. I'll use that. And then I did. And then, of course, once I then became a jazz, you know, really into jazz, I found out who Hoagie was, that he wrote a tune called Judy. And, yeah. And so I would say very few people, now your audience is going to know, or people who read the book, but most people know me as Judy Carmichael.
That's right.
I used that name from a very young age.
Wait a minute, didn't you meet his daughter?
I met his son.
Son.
That makes it even funnier.
That's weird.
Because then I met his son, who's also named Hoagie. And someone brought him into a club, and now this was years later, playing in New York. This is probably about 10 years later. And he said, "Hoagie Carmichael, Judy Carmichael." And I didn't believe him. I thought people called him Hoagie as a nickname because he obviously wasn't the Hoagie Carmichael. And I said, "Oh, people sometimes call me Hoagie, too." And he said, "Well," then we talked a little bit. Then I played. And then on the break, he came up to me, and he had tears in his eyes, and he said, oh my God, my father would have loved you. Let's talk about our relatives and figure out if we're related. Then I was horrified because I realized he was Hoagie's son.
Oh my God.
And I hadn't taken it seriously. And then he never knew that. I never let him know. But I did tell him, I broke it to him that I wasn't a Carmichael. And he said, where did you get the name? And I told him the story. And he knew. He said, oh yeah, my grandmother, that was her big tune. She always played Maple Leaf Rag.
Wow.
So it came full circle. I mean, that is a really crazy story.
Among many.
Right.
Now, what's interesting is that you still were not sure. You weren't mm-hmm. that enthusiastic about the music until somebody gave you a cassette of Count Basie in 1932. And that changed your life. Why?
Oh, it completely changed it. Well, I liked ragtime. And I really liked acting. And actually, at the time, I always had a knack for improvisational comedy. So I would have thought I had more of a talent for that than music, because I didn't think I was that talented at music, even though everybody liked my playing, because I was so painfully aware of how much I didn't know, that I didn't have a music degree, that I was behind mm-hmm. on knowing all the tunes. And I was, all my contemporaries, all the guys, had been playing in bands since they were in their early teens, even if they were just in a rock band. And I didn't, you know, I did that one concert when I was 17, but I didn't get a full-time professional job till I was 19, which is relatively late. And you know, because you know so many jazz musicians, they start early, and classical musicians as well. So I just didn't think I was prepared. And I didn't want it to just be about me being a cute, young, 19-year-old mm-hmm. who played ragtime piano. And that was, you know, I played well, but I was getting the gigs because I was a novelty, and I was aware of that. And I didn't want it to be about that. And then I got this cassette of Count Basie, and I fell in love with it and went crazy and taught myself how to play stride. And then it was about improvising. It was much more interesting to me. I knew that that kind of music could sustain me. And even though I was every bit as insecure about if I could make a living at it, I was now so passionate about the music that that drove me forward.
There's a section in this book that I have to describe as positively surreal.
I would think there's a lot of places like that.
No, there's one place that in particular. You playing at Disneyland. As a matter of fact, it gets so weird. It almost seems like some sort of acid dream. The whole accounting of that. And first of all, it ended up being really, important for you in your in progression of you musically. But the whole situation of you sitting at Coke Corner as the pianist at Disneyland, it just sort of leaves the reader like this would make a great movie just in and of itself. It's like,
you really understood this book, and you're making me feel very good that I portrayed that correctly, because the entire 5 years at Disneyland was like some sort of drug-induced state, which is why I didn't do drugs, because I would have never survived. I mean, it is such an odd setting.
Oh.
And so weird. And the people who came, many of them were odd. And no, it was a crazy.
And you were a bit of a rebel in that role too, because you were supposed to be very straight. I mean, nobody gets to do some what they want at Disneyland. It's a very strict place. But here you are, and you're working long hours playing piano in this little costume that you have to wear, and then you start doing little skits with Thelonious Chipmunk.
Do you know? I have to share this. This was, well, you know, Chip and Dale, for everybody knows who they are. I mean, these characters are more famous than we'll ever be. And Chip and Dale would come by, and it wound up that Chip could play a little bit of piano. So I taught him how to play a monk tune, and then I would announce that Thelonious Chipmunk was going to do a duet with me. And, of course, he only had three fingers, so it really sounded like Monk. And,
whoa,
and
boom.
People were, of course, the people who got the joke thought this was the most hilarious thing ever. And I just, what's just so delightful is just a few months ago, I did a concert in California, and I haven't played out there in a while. And a bunch of people that worked with me at Disneyland came. And this guy walks up, and I didn't recognize him, and he buys my book, and I'm autographing it. And I said, and to whom should I write this? And he said, Thelonious Chip.
Oh, my God.
And there he was, my duet partner, Thelonious Chipmunk. Oh, so, yes, no, it was very, I was a rebel, and I was the first woman instrumentalist to be hired by the Disney Corporation. I'm quite proud of that. And they weren't happy that I was a woman. They would have preferred I was a man. It's just that I played the particular kind of music that they wanted. And so they decided to make this exception and let a girl, you know, slip through the cracks. And so I was in a dressing room with 10 men. There were no women, no dressing room for me. And, it was crazy. And it's a corporate gig. And I'm very grateful for the money. I'm very grateful for the experience. But jazz musicians in general, but I think jazz musicians in particular, were all about improvising. And while the good ones and the responsible ones show up on time, we do a great job and we have a good adult side, it is an odd thing to take these creative people and put them in a corporate setting and to punch a time clock and put on a crazy outfit. And that's what we did.
I read that section and it literally became a movie in my mind. Now, there's so much. I mean, by the way, for the people who are listening, we are barely scratching the surface of this book. And so we're going to run out of time. And there's so many interesting anecdotes. I'm just going to have you tell one. You did an incredible tour in China.
Oh, yeah, that was amazing.
Now, I want you to tell the story about playing I Found a New Baby.
Oh, that was so funny.
It's funny for some. It wasn't funny for people in the audience.
Well, yeah, no, I know. It was somewhat tragic. This was a tour that I did in 1992. Again, a great honor for me. It was the first tour of any kind that our government sent since Tiananmen Square, and they decided that politically it was time to try to open things up, and I was chosen to do this and bring a trio and do a month tour in China. It was very, very difficult. Many of my translators couldn't even speak English very well, and it was difficult, but, as I said, a great experience. And one of the things was that they would have always a beautiful woman who would introduce us for every concert. And I'd learned some Chinese, so I said I didn't need this person because she would dictate everything that would happen. She'd say, now's the time to applaud. Now you should stop applauding. It was always odd. And I have since found out from a friend of mine who is fluent in Chinese. That's her PhD. And we were talking about this trip, and she said that the Chinese are big on storytelling and elaborating, which I didn't know. So that is natural for them to take a short story and make it longer and hyperbolize and dramatize and all of that. So I would come out and would say, I'm going to play I Found a New Baby. That's all I would say. And every night, the introduction got longer and longer and longer. And then I would notice that people in the audience were getting upset. A couple women in the front row would be dabbing their eyes with tears. And one night, this translator in the middle of the thing, she turns to me. She's all this Chinese. And then she says, what exactly does I found a new baby mean? And I said, what do you think it means? It means I found a new sweetheart, and, you know, my baby. And she said, oh, and she had been introducing this as a woman who's walking through the woods, and she's carrying her child, and she loses the child.
Oh, my God.
She continues to walk and looks down and finds a new baby.
Oh, my God.
So it's like it's a happy ending to a tragic story. And it just, and then we would plow into this upbeat song, which I guess they thought was happy because the woman's found a new baby. No, I mean, it was talk about lost in translation. So, yes, it was challenging on a number of fronts.
The sun is red and Mao's thoughts are clear.
And Mao's thought is clear. Yeah, that was a tune that I learned. So we could.
Was that? Wait a minute. You got to talk to me more about how that played. I mean, you learned that tune and you played it.
Well, the thing this is really right. This is a good time to talk about this when we're thinking about everybody's upset about politics and what's happening in America. There was a time in China when it was only legal to play five tunes five tunes. Can you imagine? So you couldn't, you could not in public play anything but these five selected tunes.
Was this one of them?
And this was one of them. It's a Cultural Revolution tune.
Did it really swing?
Oh my God. It's a horrible tune. It's like, I can't even do it. But it was called The Sun is Red and Mouse Thought is Clear. So,
because he found a new baby.
Say again?
Because Mao found a new baby.
Because Mao found a new baby. Well, so we learned this tune that only had a few notes, a few intervals.
Wow.
And then we would play it because everybody recognizes it. And then we would sort of improvise with it to give them the
concept. That's really interesting. That's really fabulous.
Improvising. And so they could see what that means.
Yep.
To take a melody and then improvise with it. But, I mean, no, the thing, it was really difficult. It'd be, you know.
So you don't play it on stage now?
No, that's something that...
Even if I requested it, if I was in the audience and I requested it?
Yes.
Judy,
I decided to move on from my Chinese period, yes.
We're completely out of time, and as you can tell, there's an awful lot in this book, and it's well worth your time to read it. It's a wonderful memoir. My guest tonight is Steinway artist Judy Carmichael, one of the leading interpreters of classic swing, stride piano, and Maoist songs, and host of NPR's Judy Carmichael's Jazz Inspired, and we're talking about her memoir. It is wonderful. It's a really interesting read. Swinger! Exclamation point. A jazz girl's adventures from Hollywood to Harlem and actually all over the world. Judy, thank you so much for your time. We could talk about this book for hours.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'll consult with you when we make the movie. I appreciate
Please,
it.
Please, I want to see a film of at least some part of this book. Maybe just you and Rod Stewart.
Ooh, well, that was memorable.
It was. See, you have to read the book to find out what we're talking about. Say no more, Judy. Say no more. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.